Sunday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, 15 and 60 for the Western Conference. Let's get right to it. Danny, what's up?
Doing well. How are you?
Both my fantasy teams lost today in football, so now I don't have to bother paying attention to that anymore, and I can be even more consumed by the NBA than I already am.
That sounds unhealthy.
Yeah, but of course, following around a lot of players and cheering when they get points is much healthier. You're right.
Yeah, it is. I have to say that as somebody who's hopefully still alive in a couple leagues. So,
well, let's talk about someone who is getting healthier, which is Chandler Parsons of the now 16-12 Dallas Mavericks, 4-3 since we last checked in on them about 2 weeks ago. And Parsons is getting back to playing his regular minutes these last three games, 28, 29, and 31 minutes, respectively. And he definitely helps them because they don't really have a ton of NBA wing players on their team. But he doesn't look like he's quite back to being the same guy, which is expected given the procedure that he underwent.
It is, and so you can talk more about the recovery time, but one of the things that's been encouraging is just really getting the minutes up. And I mean that I think that being able to handle that is probably a step before being able to provide quality minutes, but if you can do that, then that's just a step in the process.
Yeah, Parsons, he's shooting about 33% on threes for the year. Not a guy who I think is ever going to be kind of a 40% three-point shooter, but you know, he can get 36, 37, maybe even 38% on a good year when he's right. And the other big part of his game is getting to the basket off of 1 foot. And he's a guy who knows how to play, can pass a little bit out of the pick and roll, can attack off of closeouts a little bit. But the difference that I've noticed from him is that his explosion finishing at the rim off of 1 foot really is not there yet. Whenever he's contested, he's really been struggling when he gets there. Doesn't have the explosion, especially off that right leg, which is the injured one. He's wearing a sleeve on it. And so a lot of his layups are short. A lot of them are kind of getting blocked. And so it's clear that he isn't there yet with the explosiveness that he used to have. And especially just also he's, you know, at 27, you're starting to lose some of your pure athleticism. So that's going to be something to monitor. It would be great if he came back just looking like full strength. That's kind of not how these things really work. But we don't know for sure if that's ever going to fully come back, even, you know, adjusting for the fact that he's a little bit older than he was last year.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. What have you just thought more generally about the Mavericks? I haven't watched a ton of them recently, but I was sitting there and what I kept on being impressed with was that they were in games against teams that I thought, you know, had more natural talent than them. And when you think about it, that they're doing that when they're still working their way back into shape. They're one of those teams that kind of happens with me sometimes with the Celtics where I'm sitting there and I watch them and I think, I don't think they're as good as the other team, but they're still winning comfortably anyway.
I don't feel that way as much about the Celtics because the Celtics are doing it with real good defense and a lot of real good individual defenders. And I think that they can defend better than any specific thing that the Mavericks do. I mean, the Mavericks know how to play. They're well coached. And I think that they can kind of stay in the game, that they're not going to lose to teams that they shouldn't all that often. But I think they really just have some major flaws on the team. They have nobody who can block a shot right now. I mean, maybe JaVale McGee will get back to that, but it doesn't seem like the kind of guy that Carlisle is really going to trust. And he's basically has missed almost 2 years of basketball, essentially. And then Pachulia, not particularly athletic. We know Dirk's defensive limitations. And then even on the wing, Matthews is kind of good, steady. Parsons, average at best, probably a little bit worse than that. Nobody really who's a great defender, a point guard, either, especially with Devin Harris playing less now. So it's really, and I think last I checked, they're 18th in offense. So it's hard for me to see how this team, you know, I think they're going to just sort of putz along. They'll be, you know, 10th in offense and they'll be, you know, 18th, 20th in defense. That's kind of going to be their destiny. And they'll be a little bit above average team, perhaps, especially if they can pull out close games with the help of Carlisle at the end. But not a team that I really see as, you know, being a threat to anybody, unfortunately.
Well, and I think they're maybe arguably the biggest beneficiary of the West, bottom of the West playoff picture being weaker than we expected it to be, particularly a team like New Orleans, because there's going to be less pressure there than I think we would have expected.
And I don't mean to diminish what they're doing.
Certainly.
They're playing well above their talent level. And Carlisle is doing a wonderful job. You and I both thought this team was going to win 35, 38 games. The guys who are coming back from injury, I mentioned Parsons. Matthews is starting to round into form a little bit, but those guys are looking a lot better than anyone could reasonably have thought. Dirk looks better than anyone could reasonably thought he would. They're definitely doing a good job considering what their limitations are, but we also have to be honest about those limitations at the same time. All right, before we move on to the Nuggets, let me tell you about DraftKings.com. The NBA season is rounding into shape now as we're getting close to Christmas. As the players find their groove, you can play GM and draft a new team every night at DraftKings.com. Millions in prizes are being paid out this season, and with Daily Fantasy, there's no season-long commitment, so you don't need to spend months micromanaging a roster. It's like a brand new season every day at DraftKings. Just play whenever you want, and you can win serious cash that night. DraftKings even offers games that are 100% free to play, so you've got nothing to lose if you want to just play with your buddies. Or you can create new rivalries with fantasy players from all over the country and put some more at risk and maybe get a changing payday. So this isn't fantasy as usual. It's DraftKings. Use the promo code CAPSPACE at DraftKings, and you can play for free with your first deposit. CAPSPACE is very easy to remember because we talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the show. And so use that for free entry at DraftKings.com.
Well, and that leads us into a team that actually used their cap space in arguably the most interesting way this year, which was the Denver Nuggets, because it's something we talked about with the renegotiate and extend. And one of the guys who they did that with is out, but the other guy, Danilo Gallinari, is having himself a bounce back year, I think would be the right way to put it.
Yeah, although he had shown really kind of towards the end of last year that he was back at that level and then had a nice Eurobasket. So I don't know if this is entirely unexpected, but the good thing is that he at least has stayed healthy. That's the biggest thing for him when he's coming off of that ACL procedure. And then they botched where they didn't actually repair it. They just tried to kind of rehab it at the Stedman Clinic, which kind of messed up quite a few guys, including Russell Westbrook's surgeries. And so now he is back. He is a different player though, and he's been very effective. But a lot of that is just with the jump shot. He still gets to the foul line at an amazing rate. He's got over a 50% free throw to field goal ratio. But he's shooting basically 50% at the rim, which is horrible. The league average is 60, and he's a 6'10" guy. And then also, he can't score at all in kind of the short mid-range areas. So really the way to defend him is make him put the ball on the floor and then just get a big man over there and defend without fouling. If you don't want to go crazy going for the shot block, he's driving, looking to get fouled every time, but it's really going to be difficult for him to finish. And so he certainly, the fact that he's been able to remain as efficient as he has by getting to the line, considering the lack of threats, is very impressive. But also, he's a guy who, if you have good defense, can be defended.
Yeah, he's somebody who I think would fit in really nicely with this team if they can build the surrounding talent to the level that we expect. And some of that will be Nurkic when he comes back. And a guy who's really impressed me, who I was high on before he's drafted, but he'd long fallen off, is Will Barton. And Barton has, I think he's playing with more confidence. He's shooting, I think it's about 38% from three this year. And it's too early to really talk about awards, but I mean, I think he's worked himself, if he can play like this, into the Sixth Man of the Year conversation.
Yeah, or even most improved potentially as well. He's certainly someone who was never thought of as a shooter or much more than really an energy guy. Who is this? Is this his third year? Is he going to be a restricted free agent after this?
No, I think he made it through his first. He was a second round pick. I think he made it through his first contract. So I think he just signed, I think, a 3-year deal with Denver.
That's right. Yeah, he signed with them as a restricted free. Yeah, that was like sort of a deal that was under the radar and like pretty late. He's
like
a guy
312 or something like that.
Yeah, so he's looking very, very underpaid. That's another nice little coup from the Denver front office. And I think in large part they've been nailing their kind of smaller moves. It's just you still wonder who the future star is on this roster. Maybe Nurkic can turn into that. Maybe Moutier. But you know, I think of those guys' ceilings as more kind of lower end all star, not like foundational type of player necessarily.
Yeah, and it's going to be hard for them to really bring their assets together into something bigger because they're even kind of a step down from what Boston has. You think Jokic has had a really nice year, but you're not going to roll in guys like Jokic into a fringe all-star guy. You know, you're going to need a lot more than that. And they're a team in some ways, though there's plenty of time for this to change, that You know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. I was like, I hope they fall off a little bit just because I think it, like, if they could be at 8 and jump into the top 3, I think that's the type of thing that could really kickstart their development.
And one other thing I've always wanted to talk about, just a little observation. Seth has been talking a lot lately about how there are different types of defense to be good at. And it's not just, oh, he can get better on his defense. I mean, I think defense, sort of the types of defense correlate more than the types of offense do necessarily, because just being quick, being smart, you know, those sorts of things will pay off in all aspects of defense, you know, having length, et cetera, athleticism. But Randy Foy, not someone you would ever think of, you know, a 32-year-old guy, as a great post defender, but he is awesome. Like, when you try to post him up, somehow he will just, like, block guys. Like, even going back to 2-3 years ago, I want to say in Carmelo's first game back in Denver, Carmelo tried to post him up for a game winner, and Foy blocked it. And even when I saw him in person against the Bulls, they tried to post him up with Jimmy Butler or McDermott a couple of times, and he just would not be moved. And he somehow just has great timing to get his hand on turnaround jump shots. So that's just, if you think you got easy meat on Randy Foy in the post, he doesn't look it, but you don't.
Yeah, and it's a great point. I think that also extends to, like, stuff like on-ball, off-ball. I think there's something to be said there about that. There's certain guys just with what your attentiveness is and what you pay attention to. And there is a lot of nuance there, and guys can be good at specific elements of it without maybe even having the whole package, or have a certain deficiency as well.
All right, let's talk about the Warriors. I think the most interesting thing about them is that game that we were both at on Friday, where they struggled again with the Bucks. And we talked about how, I talked to everyone who was at the game too, I couldn't remember another time where a team had basically put pressure on itself, not only to win, but almost like if they didn't blow the team out, it was a disappointment. Jeremy was asked about that after the game, and he basically said, yeah, you know, it was disappointing not to play better, although he framed it more in terms of we have larger goals than beating the Bucks. But what is it about this Bucks team that they match up so well against Golden State?
I think it's a couple of different things, and one of them is, of course, the obvious one is that their length is there, but also something that you mentioned during the game to me, and once you mentioned it, it really changed the way it framed for me, was that they have guys who can post up at a lot of different spots and guys who are comfortable doing that, and so that allows them to take advantage of switches and mismatches, which is something the Warriors love to do.
Yeah, you're talking about they love to switch, you mean. So
yes.
Yeah, and for Michael Carter-Williams going one-on-one against Steph basically for the entire first half was just killing him, whether it was posting up, getting in too deep and just hitting a short hook shot, whether it was just crossing him over and getting to the basket. And Carter-Williams was doing a nice job of being able to kind of pull up just before the help can get there. And it makes such a difference, too, in terms of getting help. If you just get beat on a straight line drive, then that makes it much harder to get the help over there. And that's what was happening to Steph. He had an awful, awful defensive first half. I mean, we've seen really in these last 4 or 5 games, going back to the Boston game, teams really trying to focus in on going at him. And in that game, even in Milwaukee, they did that. And it was the same here. When they tried to hide Steph on OJ Mayo, then they would just run, you know, a pick and roll with Mayo setting the screen. It wasn't really even a real pick and roll. You know, OJ Mayo is not like some pick and roll master. But you know, they knew that what the Warriors did was switch. And so then it was Steph right back on Carter Williams or Giannis or Chris Middleton or someone. And he really, until the very end, had a lot of trouble handling that. And then the Warriors just didn't get good enough help either, because this is a team that's not a great shooting team. They shot 4 of 18 on threes for the game, and they couldn't get anyone at the rim to help out either.
Yeah, and something else that I've thought about with the Bucks is that usually this season in particular, they haven't played fast. They played slow, and while, you know, they might have some talent deficiencies and they have issues, for me, with the guys that they have, they should be offensively, they should be pushing the pace as much as possible, because that's how they can generate looks. This is a team that can struggle in the half court, and for whatever reason, in both games against the Warriors, they did a nice job of that, and I think it helped them get in rhythm. A guy like Giannis, I think that his offensive game is much more conducive to success in that style of format, and Jabari was a monster in transition in the game in Oakland.
Yeah, that was true too, although finally, when the Warriors started getting stops, and the Bucks also just couldn't hit a shot. I mean, their Mayo, I think, was 0 for 6. Middleton was like 2 for 7 or something. And those guys, they're 4 of 18 overall. So those are really the only two guys who take threes on that team, especially with Jared Bayless being out. But yeah, I guess we're talking a little bit too much about the Bucks. Walton also probably had his oddest coaching game of the year, I felt like.
It definitely was. And the challenge for me, it's something that I've been a little bit bothered by, is Luke has done a great job in certain capacities, but his rotations can be problematic in this game. He played a fair amount of Maurice Spates at the four, and it just
doesn't... Again, yeah, I thought he had weaned himself off of that against Phoenix when he went with Rush, as he should have, and then he went right back to it again because I guess Johnny O'Brien is too big of a threat inside. You know, you got to have Spates in there instead of Rush.
And it's a hard issue because Spates is a guy who has endeared himself to the coaching staff, and he's been very understanding, largely of having a smaller role. But he should play center, and there are two centers plus Draymond on this team who are better than he is. That's just the way things are.
Yeah, it is. And when he hasn't been hitting his jumper at all this year either. I mean, that's really the only reason to play him at the four. The Warriors did get some really nice minutes from James Michael McAdoo as they kind of turned the game over a little bit. But I thought when they were down by 11, or I think down by 9 to start the fourth, and then Walton went to that lineup, that they were going to really lose it. And they managed to only lose, I think, 3 points while Spates was in there. And then Walton actually went back to all of his guys with the under three timeout, I think, in large part because they have all this time off afterwards. And that really won the game, because then he was going against the Bucks reserves for 2-3 minutes, and they got right back into it at that point. And that's when it was basically they're able to bring it home. But still, even more weird stuff, like he had Rush in the game at the end instead of Iguodala until the very end, and Giannis was able to get a couple of buckets on Rush. I didn't really understand. And the only reason he did that was just because Rush had hit a few shots earlier. I mean, all right, yeah, you want to go with the hot hand, but it's Andre Iguodala and it's Brandon Rush. Like, I don't care how many shots Brandon Rush hit that game. Like, you got to go with Andre Iguodala.
Agreed. I asked him the question about that post game, and I basically asked him what his thought process was, and what I interpreted from his answer was he would go with whoever played better. But to me, the answer is Andre Iguodala is straight up the better player, and without Harrison Barnes out there, the answer of who your five best guys are is a lot clearer than it would be otherwise. And so you just play Iguodala with that group. He helps give you a defensive identity, and Rush is very, he can hit open shots. He's doing a really nice job of that. But if that's really what a guy does, it gives the other team a lot less to work against. You know, it makes their life a lot easier.
Yeah, and also just the inability really to find a counter to some of the simple stuff that the Bucks were doing. Granted, it was, you know, a lot of it was just Steph getting beat individually, but not getting more help at the rim against a team that is not a good, doesn't shoot very well. That also, I felt like, was a failing, but they still ended up winning by 10 ultimately. Let's move on to Houston, 14-14. They are 4-3 since we last talked, but they have won three straight, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think they've won 7 out of their last 10.
Still not a team that I am incredibly high on. Ty Lawson has basically got a DNP last game against the Clippers when they beat them, another kind of disappointing team. What are some of the differences just in their overall statistical resume between this year and last year?
Well, I think the obvious difference is that their defense isn't nearly as efficient as it was last year. But what I've been more intrigued by is what is similar. And so last year, they were third worst in turnover rate, and they were their second this year, second from the bottom behind the Sixers, of course. And that was surprising to me just because I didn't realize that it was that way last year. And of course, the hope was that they were going to have a little bit of a different identity, but they're largely that same way. And another thing that they've struggled with both seasons is defensive rebounding.
Yeah, this year especially, they've kind of felt the need to go small more often, but they don't really have a guy, because Ariza, even when you're going small, he generally has to guard the biggest wing threat on the other team. So he's not going to be near the basket. Then you're stuck with Harden, basically, and then they don't even have anyone else who's like a wing, who's like a real strong guy. Harden, a lot of times, will be the one who's guarding the other team's four, or if they're going smaller, or, he'll be guarding kind of a non-threat, but he's not going to be, you know, a great defensive rebounder. Howard can only do so much, basically. And when he's out, if it's someone like Muddy Unis these days, or, you know, even Capella is pretty decent, but also a guy who can kind of get beasted physically and pushed under the basket at times, depending on who the matchup is. Ariza, not a great rebounder. if you're playing Terry or Lawson, neither of those guys can rebound at all. So, you know, it's really, other than Dwight Howard, they don't have anyone who's a good rebounder on this team, unless you're going to look at maybe like Terrence Jones, but he hasn't played very much.
Yeah, and that's one of the big challenges with this team, is just figuring out where they want to go, because they have a lot of big decisions to make in the near term. And whenever I watch them, I kind of think about if I had that decision, how much trouble I'd be having it with right now. Of course, you still have time to figure it out, but I mean, Demo, Jones are both going to be restricted next year. Dwight's probably going to opt out, and so they have a lot that they need to figure out in the next 5 months.
Yeah, they're almost certainly going to dump Lawson because he made his $13 million for 2016-17 non-guaranteed, and he's not quite living up to that so far.
Yeah, that's pretty much a definite now. Like, I mean, he would have to play so well for them to pick that up.
Yeah, no, he really would, and he certainly is not trending in the right direction. He had maybe like two games where you're like, okay, looks like he's starting to, but I mean, he's like right up there for one of the worst players to get regular minutes this year in all of basketball, with his just complete lack of competition on defense. And then just, you know, even offensively, like he hasn't done anything at all. Even at times when he has been, running the offense himself, you know, you can't put it all on the fact that he's playing next to Harden. He's been totally inefficient in even the chances that he does get. So, and let's assume Houston, all right, they make a little bit of a run. Maybe they finish this the year with 45, 46 wins. Howard opts out. You know, I mean, what do you have now on this team outside of James Harden that really can get you back to contention? It's not a great free agent class. You know, I mean, are you going to sign Al Horford or Mike Conley? Like, probably not, you know. So those are the only guys that I feel like in free agency who could really make a difference to get this team back to where it needs to be. They have some assets, but nothing that's really like a crown jewel. I think, you know, Capella, I think, can be like maybe an above average starter someday. And maybe you say, all right, let's turn over the center position to him, but he's probably not experienced enough yet to really be the center on a contending team that you're relying on every day. So really, it's difficult, right? I mean, if they won 55 games this year and they were right in it again in the West, then you say, all right, let's run it back with Dwight again, and you know, we have to overpay, but we're right there. You know, it's worth doing that for a contender. But it seems clear to me, if they keep playing this way, that they're not one move away. And if they bring the band back or pay Dwight Howard $25 million for over 5 years, then they're going to be locked in there. Daryl Morey is not the type of guy who's going to want to do that. But on the other hand, I mean, we've seen that their owner, Les Alexander, had those very frustrated public comments at the firing of McHale, which basically, you know, he's never gone to that level. So maybe, perhaps unfairly, because Morey built this team into a contender last season out of nothing, he could start getting on the hot seat a little bit and may not feel comfortable enough that his grand move of getting Dwight, he's now going to let him go. Even if that is the right move, he might feel a little uncomfortable doing that.
And they're also in a tough spot because Monty Eunice and Terrence are both going to be in the spot where they're not really assets over the summer, because you can re-sign them and they have low cap holds, which is really nice, but it's very rare to get an asset of real any value in a sign-in trade, even for a restricted free agent. I mean, Grievous Vasquez is the best one off the top of my head of a guy who you get in that, so you're probably, if you're committing to those guys, they can become assets.
Yeah, Tyreke Evans, yeah.
Well, yeah, that was
Grievous in the Tyreke Evans
trade. In the Tyreke Evans trade, like, the guy they got back was Grievous Vasquez, and so I think that, so they're obviously they're good players, but you're running a risk with guys like that. They could also very well be overpaid, depending on, because teams are going to have a lot of money even after the moratorium, in my opinion. So they're gonna have some decisions with that. And Kevin Pelton wrote an interesting piece about the idea of trading Dwight Howard. I haven't really made up my mind on that, but it is something that I would be seriously considering if it were my choice.
Well, what would be enough for you of a return for you to trade him?
I mean, you'd need the hard part about it is that you'd, of course, every team is going to have a lot of salary back in there. And so you're going to have to either be taking on long-term money, or you're going to have to be getting back something that isn't very good and then trying to cobble together some like low. I would say if you could get one guy, at least one guy who you can expect to be a long-term starter, who is, let's say, 26 or younger, I think for me that would probably be enough, because I'm scared of giving Dwight his next contract, but I think I'm more scared of that than most people are.
Who needs Dwight right now? Who, I mean, just in a general sense, it's got to be a contender. It's got to be someone where you think, because Dwight Howard, clearly, as you mentioned, is a free agent. He is going to require a pretty big contract, and he's going to get it because that's just the amount of money that's around the league, basically. Although, I don't know. It'll be interesting because not that many contenders necessarily have a ton of money to spend as much as kind of the lower teams do. And presumably Dwight at this point in his career is not going to want to go somewhere just for the money. So he probably, you know, I could see him taking $20 million a year instead of 25 if that means going to a team that's at least a pseudo contender. But that said, I mean, what team could he put over the top this year? What about the Pacers?
The Pacers were one of the teams I thought of, but I think they would just be sitting there being convinced that he wouldn't resign with them. And do they, that would make them better than the Cavs. I mean, that just, it makes you better in kind of that short-term way. However, why the Pacers would be interesting is that they don't
what if you could get off of Miles, what if you traded Miles Turner, Monte Ellis? So that's, you know, that gets to maybe like $14 million. You got to get to basically, 80% of his $23 million. So
Jordan Hill.
Jordan Hill. Throw him in there. LaVoy Allen or, something like that. And then you're there. You're probably there if you throw those guys in. But then Houston has kind of some big guys already. You know, I mean, what they really need is another guy on the wing who's going to be any good. Maybe ask for Solomon Hill too, if I'm the Rockets. But if you're the Rockets, you're basically giving up on contending this year. And maybe even just the best course is just to stay and just hope everyone kind of figures it out. But maybe they could get up to like the fifth seed. I mean, they're not going to beat Oklahoma City. They're not going to beat the Spurs. They're not going to beat the Warriors. So basically, you got to get up to the fifth seed, hope you could beat the Clippers, and then, you know, you got to the second round, and it appears like it might have been a successful season. I don't know. I think that would be interesting. I mean, what do you think? Let's put aside all the optics that we talked about. If you're just, you become Rockets GM tomorrow, and you don't have to worry about PR at all, you doing that trade?
Yes. But how much I love Miles Turner. I mean, I think what he gives you is a chance of having a top half starting center in the league, and I would happily do that to a guy who's on the first year of his rookie contract and super young.
Now you're taking on Monte Ellis, horrendous fit.
Oh yeah, and a contract.
That's basically dead money.
Yeah.
You're taking on. So you're going to take on basically $30 million in dead money for Miles Turner, and you're also giving up Dwight as well, a guy who, you know, helps a lot this year and has some value. I mean, I think I probably would want more than that. Miles Turner is not a sure thing. And what's more, he's too young when you have a superstar in his prime to really kind of rebuild around, to expect that he's going to help you build a new contender around James Harden. So I don't know. That's what makes it so difficult, right?
Yeah, I agree with you, but at the same point, like the way I was thinking about it was in under the assumption that that was the best offer I had. Like if that, let's say we were sitting there on Valentine's Day and that was what I thought was the best offer we would get, would I take it? And my answer to that is yes, but it's close. I mean, that the way it was phrased was kind of beautiful because it's a lot of things I don't like, especially with that team. But I think that if you have the chance to get one of those people who can be not a building block, like let's say like a Westbrook or a Durant, but a guy who can be a really cheap fundamental piece that you can use all of your flexibility on other things, I think that's the type of thing they should be looking for.
Yeah, it's hard to make a trade to get better these days when you are already a pretty good team. You know, I mean, I guess like you can kind of give up a couple of first rounders. But to expect to get a guy who's going to, you know, for a low first round pick, to expect to, and they already out that 2016 to the Nuggets. So to expect to get someone who's going to make a difference is difficult. All right, that's probably too long on the Rockets, but I thought that was a really interesting discussion. Let's get on to the Los Angeles Clippers, another disappointing team as the West appears replete with them. Blake Griffin is not the reason why they are not playing well so far this year.
Blake is having a really nice year, and one of the things I noticed as I was kind of coming is that it's a extremely small sample size. But Blake, his points per possession as the quote-unquote ball handler in a pick-and-roll is 1.23, which is actually, he's played a lot less possessions as in that role, but it's actually substantially higher than Curry, who is the number one player among heavier use guys in that. And I think you had a theory on why that is.
Well, yeah, most of the time that he runs what, you know, Synergy would characterize as a pick-and-roll, it's usually he and Paul will play like a two-man game. And actually, I think a two-man game back in the day wasn't necessarily considered a pick and roll. It was more just two-man game between a guy entering into the post. And so they can do all sorts of things. They can run the snug pick and roll with Paul and Griffin setting the screen. Griffin can kind of just back down into the post, and then Paul will set the screen for him to release him going to the basket. They really have a great chemistry there that improvise. And then you've got DJ under the basket, so you can't really help over too far because you'll get lobbed on. And then you probably have Redick on the weak side as well. So it's a really, really difficult play to defend. And you can't switch it because then Blake will just back that guy down into the post, whoever was guarding Paul. So, yeah, it's really difficult. And that's, I think, the biggest reason why Blake has that really high points per possession as a pick-and-roll ball handler when he finishes plays.
And it also makes you think about how important that fifth guy is for their starting lineup, because you want somebody who they respect the shot so they don't gum up the works in terms of all that, but you also ideally would want somebody who can at least defend his own position. It would be great if they could defend the slide over to the two as well to handle the most dangerous guys, and they've had a lot of trouble finding that player since they traded Matt Barnes.
Yeah, and two of the teams that they're going to play in the West, you know, that play works great when you have a traditional point guard defending Paul, but Curry can just hide on, you know, the fifth player, we'll call him. And same thing with Tony Parker. And so, you know, if you're guarding Paul with Kawhi, you can probably just switch that and put Blake on him. And Klay Thompson, I mean, he's not, you know, going to really stand up that well to Blake, but he'll do a better job than like a normal point guard would. So having that guy that you can hide a point guard on, makes it more difficult for the Clippers, but it's still a fantastic play. Let's move on to the Lakers. The Clippers, by the way, 16-12, 5-3 in their last eight. The Lakers, 4-23, 1-6. They did blow out the Bucks at home. And you posited whether they are actually any better than the Sixers right now.
And the main reason I say that is whenever I watch them, I see a team that if you are diligent, and the way I phrase it is if you do two passes or actions against their defense, you're going to get a clean look. That look may not go in, but you're going to get a clean look. And so you're scoring a lot, and that it's not even about feedback loops. You're scoring a lot, and their offense is just not creative. They don't really have the right guys for it. So I feel like with most teams, if you had certain talent, and incidentally, the Bucks are a team that doesn't fit this bill, I feel like it would be easier to beat the Lakers, though they have a higher variance because they have offensive players who can catch fire for a given night.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Lakers are substantially better than the Sixers. The Sixers aren't blowing out anybody at home. I don't care who they are. The way the Lakers did to the Bucks the other night. And Kobe actually has started to be pretty efficient, like low-key these last six or seven games. He's actually like having, you know, more points and shooting possessions pretty regularly. He's doing some nice playmaking. It was a shame actually to see that amazing dunk that he had on Capella the other night as they were getting completely destroyed, by the way. And that is the thing about the Lakers. Like, they could be pretty competitive against bad teams, but like anytime they play anyone remotely good, they just get absolutely destroyed. Like, same thing happened against the Thunder. I mean, they were down by 30, you know, like halfway through the second quarter already, and then the Rockets too blew them out by 20 at home, and that's not even that good of a team. But anyway, like, what Kobe's thing made me think of is, what are the things about being old? Yeah, your physical capacity decreases. Like, that's one thing. The other one is that you have less days when you feel good. But the third thing is that if you really push your body to go as hard as it can, you can still do things like that Kobe dunk, but then he injured himself in that dunk. And that's why you don't see older guys go as hard as they can that often, because there's always this kind of thought in the back of your mind that, you might hurt yourself if you go real hard, or that if you go real fast, you're not necessarily going to be able to stop, and you can get out of control a little bit, or you can injure yourself trying to stop. That's another one of sort of the psychological aspects of being an old player that, you know, is why Father Time's undefeated, I guess.
Yeah, it definitely is something that I've thought about more, especially as I've gotten a little bit older myself. And you do have to, and with Kobe, of course, that injury history is so present that you know it has to be in the back of his mind.
Yeah, I agree. So regardless of whether they're better or worse than the Sixers, I think it is almost impossible for them to not finish with the second worst, at least, record in basketball.
Agreed. Yeah, I talked about this a little bit with Seth when I had him on last week, and I just feel like no matter what they do, if they try really hard, if they try moving pieces, and so what I started thinking about once I kind of had that idea was, how does that affect what you do from a personnel perspective for the rest of the season?
Yeah, I think they probably, you should definitely go for a fire sale of whoever it is. I mean, the dream of playing well enough to actually appeal to free agents and thinking, oh yeah, we could be the missing piece to being a contender again, that's over now. Like there's really, that's just not going to happen. So what you really need to do is just get to a point where you're showcasing these young guys absolutely as much as possible. And yeah, you know, just let them average as many shots and points a game as they want to. If the defense is terrible, fine. Whatever. I mean, it's all about just trying to make those guys look good if you want to have some free agent success, which I think, you know, is looking less and less likely. Let's move on to the Memphis Grizzlies, 15-14, but a mere 3-5. As we talked about the other night, they have taken Zebo and Tony Allen out of the starting lineup. And I mean, it seems like even with their traditional style, the only thing that they're still doing that you would think of as really being a great aspect of Memphis Grizzlies basketball is they still create a lot of turnovers on defense. But this is a team that's 22nd in the league in offensive rebound percentage, which is disturbing when you think of like what the Grizzlies are supposed to be. Although they weren't that good, they're only 17th last year. And then 20th in the league in post-ups points per possession. So that's another thing that you would think that they'd be real good at, that they just have not succeeded at. And a lot of that is just Zach Randolph not being the player that he was. So the old style, I think, very clearly was not working. I don't know if the new style is going to be that much better, but I think it needed to be tried.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's two things. One, I don't think it's going to work just because they don't have the right personnel. But two, you have to give it a shot because you need to know what you have when you move forward. And they're a team that, again, I don't know what a like really what a fire sale would do with them or what they would really want, but what you're hoping is that a team really likes somebody you have, like let's say Courtney Lee. Like if a team just thinks that he's a guy who can be a nice fit.
They're not gonna do a fire sale though.
No, I don't think they are either. But just what you're hoping for is that somebody falls in love with one of your guys and that you can use that. But if not, then I think you just kind of have to roll with what you have to roll with it, because I don't think they can seriously consider moving, let's say, Gasol or Connolly in the near future. I don't think they can consider that.
No. And one thing that is interesting to me, too, that I think can chill the trade market as well, just overall around the league, is we talked about how there aren't that many teams that are clearly out of it that are sellers. But by the same token, perhaps, there are not that many teams that are going to be buyers either, because I don't think there's a player that's going to be on the market that's realistically going to have Eastern Conference teams saying, all right, we got this guy, now we're going to be Cleveland at full strength. You know, especially with Kyrie being back now, he looked like he was fine today, obviously against non-NBA competition in the Sixers, but you know, we'll get to see him in person on Christmas. And then in the West, you know, who are you going to pick up? I mean, I think the only team that I think would really have a market for someone like Courtney Lee is, of course, Oklahoma City, but they already are out now 2 first-round picks, so what are they going to trade? I mean, that's the only team I really think that could benefit and vault themselves up to being a true contender by making an acquisition. I think all the rest of these teams are just way too far below the level of San Antonio, Golden State, and Cleveland.
I agree with you on substance, but I also think that there will be teams, once it gets clear, that would be willing to take a jump just to get either into the playoffs or a better seed in the playoffs. There are teams that are going to have that sort of a pressure.
Yeah, you could see Charlotte. You could see Charlotte doing something like that.
Or New Orleans. if they got
close. Well, I think they're going to have to get a little bit closer on their own, I think, before a move like that gets made. But you might be right, which would be, I think that would be short-sighted. Maybe the Magic could be one. Maybe they think that they could get, you know, another veteran. But they have a lot of guys already in their rotation, so.
I thought about Dallas, too, just because he would add some depth to
They don't have anything to trade, though.
That's true.
I mean, because they're already out the Rondo pick, and they certainly don't have any young talent on their roster since they have neglected the draft for so long. But anyway, yeah, I mean, back to the Grizzlies. We'll see how this works out. I mean, I think that'll be real interesting. Maybe I'll try to get someone from Memphis on in the next couple of weeks or so once this new kind of smaller approach with Barnes and Green starting it forward begins to take hold and see, all right, what's the zeitgeist there and how well is that doing? Let's get to the Minnesota Timberwolves. 3-5 in their last 8, 11-16 overall, 4-10 only at home, although they finally are starting to win a few home games. But, you know, they still have some fairly maddening lineup construction.
They do, and we've talked about the Zach LaVine at point guard situation, and something that I was intrigued by when I was looking at different Wiggins with different guys who he can play with is that they have been atrocious when Kevin Martin plays with Wiggins. And what I noticed about that was when you look at the different combinations is that what might be partially explaining that is that that lineup, those combination plays more with LaVine at point guard than with the other, with their more traditional guys. And that is might be what's kind of poisoning that well.
Yeah. And also just the fact that Martin just isn't that good. He's not having a good year. I mean, we've said this before that he's basically like, other than shooting, he basically plays, although he's a veteran, he basically plays like a young guy with the way he defends. So he's not really giving you much of that kind of veteran presence. Yeah, any other kind of weird lineup quirks that you've noticed about this team?
Well, Wiggins has been a positive with both Rubio and Prince. Or no, sorry, Rubio and Miller, actually, and Tayshaun Prince, but that's a starter backup issue. And so they have that, but then what's been kind of weird is that, like, so Shabazz Muhammad and Wiggins have mostly played with LaVine as the point guard, and those minutes are just atrocious, which isn't surprising.
Yeah, yeah, well, you know, you do think, all right, we're going to play Andre Miller with those two guys. That's another guy who likes to post up a little bit, can't shoot at all. So going into the post with those guys, especially Shabazz, with Miller on the floor, doesn't really work. I mean, they don't have any other point guards who can shoot, really. I mean, Rubio is having, you know, even a worse season than he's had for these last few years, even though he still somehow manages to be a positive influence on the court. So, you know, I don't know. I still would really like to see Tyus Jones get some minutes. And Sam Mitchell has been under fire. We have killed him a lot. But that said, this team has made a ton of improvement. And now part of that, you can say, hey, you know, they have Wiggins. He's really good. They have Towns. He's really good. But some of that, you know, I'm not sure how much of that you can say is in spite of Mitchell instead of at least perhaps because of him. Like, they have improved a lot. Like, I mean, they were, won 16 games last year, 11-16 this year. A lot of that, too, is just because Rubio is back again. LaVine has another year of experience where he's not playing point guard as much. You know, all those things are true, and Towns is actually a decent defender. They have KG now. I think it is mostly personnel driven, but if you're Sam Mitchell and you're thinking like, hey, you know, this team has really improved this year. Like, why am I under fire? You can understand why he thinks that way. You know, especially because he feels like he's doing the right thing.
And they've been defending much better. And if some of that, as you said, is personnel. But I think some of it, that is one thing that I think he has really helped them with. And they're doing last year, they looked hopeless a lot of the time. And this year, it looks like their heads are on straight more of the time on that end.
The Pelicans, 8-19. They are 4-4 in their last 8. They had a nice win at Utah. They've had a couple other decent wins. What do you think the chances are of them getting a 500? I mean, I think that the whatever the last team in the West is going to be 39-40, 41 wins probably gets you there. What do they have to do to get to that level at this point over the rest of the year?
So they have to win about 60% of their games. And for reference, they won 55% last year. And of course, they had injury issues, but it's reasonable to expect that they'll still have those. I would say it's very unlikely, but fundamentally possible, just because when they're healthy, when they're together, I think they're pretty good. And
yeah, they're 0-11 to start. Is that right?
Yeah,
or I think like 0-9 or something. I mean, they're basically playing 500 ball since that really bad start.
Yeah, but what they can't do is they can't, you know, have Anthony Davis out for 5+ games for a little stretch and just fall off the wayside. Basically, they need everything to go right to be in that mix. And so, like, you know, maybe a 10-20% chance. Does that seem about right?
Yeah, maybe. And especially because I don't think of any of these teams above them as massive juggernauts necessarily. I mean, the Sacramento is playing it a lot better, you know, when Cousins is around, but, you know, he could get injured as well. I mean, I think Denver is clearly going to fall out of it. Houston, Memphis, I mean, we'll probably end up counting them in, but it's kind of Utah. Utah, I think, will start playing better, especially once Gobert gets back. But Utah, Phoenix, I mean, we'll get to them. They're not really looking like some juggernaut. So I don't think the dream is totally dead, especially because Drew is now, the minutes limit is coming to an end for him. He's starting to get it together. He's playing, you know, pretty close to last year's level now. He's at 17.7 PER on the year. But, I mean, what you said about health is huge because they still only have 5 players on this team who are, like, acceptable players for, like, what is being expected of them as far as the number of minutes that they're playing.
And it's a big issue because when you kind of put the players in any other sort of combination, they're just fatal flaws that you can exploit. You think about Oshik for lots of different reasons, or Cunningham has some benefits, but I don't love him against everybody. They've played him, I think, in my opinion, a little bit too much of the 3. I like him as a 4 a lot better. But and they have, like, Drew also gets them out of the whole playing point guards who shouldn't be playing point guard minutes in the NBA issue, even though Norris Cole has struggled as well.
Yeah, I mean, so here are the guys that are in their rotation at various points. Oshik, terrible. He's been awful. Ish Smith, you know, Bob Vilgaris actually likes him and he likes what he's been able to do with the ball in his hands, but still a guy who you just never gets guarded. And if you're going to play Ish, then, you know, you'd rather that Ish run pick and roll than Drew Holiday or Tyreek Evans. You know, you can't play, if you're going to play Ish, then you can't really play him with Evans. You know, neither of those guys can shoot. So, and I think he's also just going to regress because he's been, you know, really a third point guard type at best in his career. There's no reason to think he's going to be better. Alonzo G, good defender, can't make a shot to save his life. Cunningham, as you mentioned, I think could be more effective as a 4 and is shooting 3s this year, which helps, but he still has an 8.6 PER. You know, there's only so much you can help when you have that kind of a PER. Luke Babbitt, same thing, under 10 PER. Tony Douglas, Norris Cole is a 3 PER right now. I mean, and Ajinsa is, maybe you could look at him as like an average backup center. He's like the one guy off the bench for them who is doing anything. So, you know, you noted that they need to win about 60% of their remaining games. That's going to be real tough, especially if they have one injury among those top 5, I think they're totally sunk. One thing that was really disappointing for me about them, 29th in the league in offensive rebound percentage when you have Oshik, AD, who was a great offensive rebounder last year, and Ryan Anderson, also a guy with a lot of offensive rebounding talent. I guess the edict is, let's get back on defense, but they're not stopping anybody anyway.
Yeah, that's not a trade-off that they're succeeding at.
Let's get to Oklahoma City. We talked about them extensively on Thursday already and some of the problems that they have with their offenses. You know, in watching them, I asked the question to myself, like, is Deion Waiters maybe not that bad anymore? What do you think?
He's not that bad. He's just frustrating. And he's always been frustrating.
Well, and it really, the way that they're playing, we talked about how they never move the ball. That almost shows kind of the folly of the acquisition. Because he's not really, you know, a spot-up shooter. Like, that's not his strength. He's better at it than people think, but, you know, he's got, like, a 19.3% usage, but he's still pretty inefficient. Doesn't get to the line a lot. He's not good enough to really be the guy that you're running the offense through on the second unit, and his usage just doesn't reflect that. If you're never going to move the ball, it's not like he's some, like, tertiary creator that you're throwing it to, especially late in games. It's all Durant and Westbrook. The only shots he's going to get late in games is a spot up or maybe drive off a closeout for a crappy long two. So, you know, what is the reason for having him on this team? Like, what need is he filling? You know, you could say, all right, if we're going to move the ball from side to side, maybe we start with him in a pick and roll and then we swing it to Russ's side or something like that. But that's just not the way that they play.
It isn't. And you think about what the low usage that you're going to have if you're thinking of who the third perimeter guy is going to be with KD and Russ, then you go, okay, well, then if we have to make a choice, then we want a guy who's at least capable defensively, and the minimum would be that they're not a regular record scratch on offense. And Waiters is not good enough at defense to justify that. So coaches, I don't think a coach would feel comfortable giving him crunch time minutes next to those guys, and that makes it even harder to sell.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's interesting. Reggie Jackson was probably a guy who wasn't happy there. They really believe in culture. They didn't want that, although, you know, Waiters was not no saint either, but he's been better when he's been there. And, you know, I think he deserves credit at least for, despite the fact that he doesn't get a ton of shots, like not carping about it too badly. I think within the role that he's been asked to play, he's doing it as well as he can. You know, I think he deserves some credit for that. And he hasn't been totally horrible defensively late in games, but you know, he just doesn't really have those talents that they need. I think they really miss Reggie Jackson though, because DJ Augustin is not playing well. He can basically what he's reduced to now is, you know, being a good three-point shooter, standstill three-point shooter, but he doesn't offer a ton more. His finishing at the rim is degraded. He's been really bad defensively. Thunder fans are kind of asking for campaign, but as a rookie, it's really hard to expect that he's going to be either efficient or that he is going to be any better than Augustin defensively, despite having better tools. So, you know, I think that they really miss Reggie because he was a guy who could play alongside Russ and KD, you know, probably better than Waiters could in some ways. And he had some huge playoff games where he had 30 points. You know, he saved them in 2014 in that game against the Grizzlies that went into overtime. So, you know, they really miss him, and I don't know if there was really that much of an option because he didn't want to stay there. But you know, they could have just held on to him and then re-signed him and for the money that he got, matched an offer, and instead of Cantor, he might have still been unhappy there. But I don't know. I'm not saying that they necessarily shouldn't have traded him, but you know, they just didn't get enough back for him, and then for those two picks that they sent out.
Yeah, they sold low. I think that's the bigger thing. And what I liked about Reggie, and this is what I was really always intrigued by with Eric Bledsoe, both when he was almost on the Thunder and when he was on the Clippers, is that I love a guy who can shoulder the load on the second unit, but can be a smaller piece in a bigger scheme with the first unit. Like, to me, those are kind of some of my favorite players. And he can do that. You know, I don't think it was his favorite thing to do, but it was something that he was worth doing. He was worth it in that role. And you think about just the difference in a way between him and Cantor. I mean, he's a guy who can play with the big boys, who can do that, and who could have thrived, you know, kind of being that offensive locus for the second unit. But then you play him, you can still play him starter minutes, and I think that would have been nice. And I understand that they were kind of, if you could call it, aiming higher and what they were doing, but I also was super low on Enes Kanter, but it's another one of those misses that was a chance at getting the right fit, and it just didn't happen.
Yeah, two first-round picks and Reggie Jackson, granted in the last year of his contract, but still restricted for basically guys who aren't really helping them that much, frankly. Let's move on to Phoenix, 12-17, 4-4 somehow. In their last eight, we saw them in person against the Warriors, which is always kind of a rough litmus test because that Warriors team is so good. Although the Warriors just, you know, completely destroyed them in that second and third quarter. I'm really disappointed in their defense, which is, you know, almost down to like 20th now. Like, that I think was going to be their bread and butter. Part of it is that Tyson Chandler missed a bunch of time. And then even in the game against the Warriors, you could see him grabbing at that hamstring periodically. I'm not sure that he even is quite back yet, or at least wasn't as of a week ago. So that's a little bit concerning. He did not look like the force that he has been. And, you know, he's getting up there. I think 33 now. This is his like 15th year, I want to say. So that's a little bit of a concern. Alex Len is not really ready to be a starting center either. And so then they're kind of going a lot with these lineups that have John Luehr and Mirza Teletovic. And so ultimately that leads to not having that good a defense. And they also don't have like a true stopper on the wing. Tucker is a guy who competes but doesn't necessarily have the physical skills. So that's disappointing. And then offensively, you look at them, they have some guys who can play a little bit, but do they have anyone that you think of as like a smart offensive player on this team?
I mean, Chandler has had that rep at certain places, but he's not.
Yeah, but he's not handling the ball at all, right? Yeah. I mean, he sets good screens for sure. You know, that's something to consider. But yeah, I think, and even defensively as well. Who do you think of even as a smart defensive player? Maybe Tucker is a guy who's okay, but I don't think of him as like some kind of basketball genius. Yeah. And then
like Bledsoe's more tenacious than smart. I mean, he's a physical talent, and I love the guy, but that's not really what he does super well. And Brandon Knight is another guy who's an athletic talent who, being a basketball IQ, is not really what he's known for. So that is a big issue. And for them, like, it's they have those two guys who, in Knight and Bledsoe, who can do a nice job bringing down their offense. But something else that they've done is that I noticed in that game was that they've played them together way too much, especially when you have a third guy in Devin Booker, who, as a guy who can hit open shots, he needs somebody to create those shots. And while that game was not representative, he, you know, you want to play him in those minutes, and he's good enough to warrant, you know, being a part of their rotation. So playing him with Ronnie Price is just not a good use of what he can do.
Yeah, that I think that makes sense. Although Booker, he played the role as sacrificial lamb for a rookie shooting guard who got completely lit up by Klay Thompson in an amazing quarter when he had that 27. He just, like, Booker's going to be having nightmares about that, just like Nick Stauskas was for the 37-point quarter last year. So that's he's definitely not ready defensively to really guard the best players, and Phoenix doesn't necessarily have anyone else either who's going to take on that role. So if Booker is not hitting shots and he has come back to earth a little bit, it is kind of harder to play him for a team that is kind of trying to make the playoffs, a coach in the last year of their contract that has some pressure after having missed the playoffs every year since 2010. The Blazers, 11-18, a disappointing 2-6 in their last eight. They actually have a much better point differential, though, than you would expect. I think they're only -1 points per game. So that's a little bit encouraging, and I wouldn't count them out quite yet in that battle for the eighth seed.
But it's getting close. I mean, because they're not as good as those teams. They have players.
They've played a lot of road games too. You know, I think
that's true.
And they're a team that I think is going to be especially tough at home, with their young guys liking to run a little bit. You know, the fact that Portland is, you know, a 2-hour flight from anywhere.
Yeah, it's an unusual home court advantage of basically just being a pain in the butt to get to. But one thing that concerned me is that when you think about their defensive identity, is that they don't force turnovers. They're third from the bottom in that, and they also foul a lot. They're third from the bottom in free throws allowed per field goal, and so that combination can be overcome. There are ways that you can do it. But you have to be, you know, you have to have a really good effective field goal defense. You have to be a team that's basically making your opponent shoot hard shots and getting a ton of rebounds in order to make that work. And yeah, they have some offensive pieces, but it's going to be hard to get that defense to a level, though Stotts did it last year with talent that didn't seem well suited for that.
Yeah. You know, you talked about the fouling, right? And I think fouling a lot is okay if it indicates that you're being aggressive. If you're blocking a lot of shots, if you're getting a lot of steals, forcing a lot of turnovers, you know, sometimes that's going to have the concomitant effect that, you know, you're reaching in a lot, you're going for blocks, you're fouling. That's not the case for this team, right? You know, they are pretty much not blocking many shots. They're not aggressive on defense. They don't have anyone who gets steals, and yet they're still fouling a lot. That basically just means they're allowing a ton of penetration, and then guys are just getting fouled at the rim. So, yeah, it's the defense. I mean, we always knew it wasn't going to be that great. I think they're doing about as well as they can, given the personnel right now with this very conservative scheme. But, you know, offensively, it's a little bit of a different story, and CJ McCollum continues to play well.
He does. He's right now in isolations. He's seventh in points per possession, which seemed high, which still actually, it just seems high to me. I was going to couch it, but it just straight up seems high to me.
Like, just because you wouldn't expect him to be that good at ISOing?
Yeah, compared to some of the guys, I mean, Corey Joseph is also high on the list, and I never would think that he's way more surprising than CJ McCollum, but he's a talented shooter. He can handle. I liked him at Lehigh, but in terms of being in that group, it might be a small sample size thing, but I just don't see him as a guy who's just going to force opponents to just have fits guarding him one-on-one, especially considering he's not big for the position he's playing.
That's true, although I think a lot of teams are putting whoever their best backcourt defender is on Dame. So that helps a little bit. And he's just a real good mid-range shooter. And, you know, isolations generally devolve into those. And he's got some pretty good moves to get open, and he can make those shots. I think when you're guarding him, what you really want to do is force him to go to the rim instead of pulling up for the jumper, where he is really, you know, has not finished well on layups at the basket. He does have a nice floater, and he's been very effective on that. But really, I think that's another guy that you really want to make him get to the rim and actually finish with a real layup over the help, instead of letting him pull up for the J. But sometimes that's easier said than done. Any other interesting stats on these guys?
Well, so there are kind of two different things with the synergy stuff that's available on NBA.com, and I highly encourage those of you that's on stats.nba. They have some of the stuff available there now. Ed Davis is actually doing really well as a pick and roll screen guy, and I kind of separated in my brain between pick and pop guys like Lure and Channing Frye and more drive roll guys like Ed Davis and Drummond. And he right now is second of the second group behind Whiteside and ahead of Drummond, Brandon Bass, and Gortat, who are next to the next guys in that same group.
Yeah, that's always something that he's been real good at, is just finishing in that area. He's got long enough arms to get up for alley-oops. And at least offensively, he has found a very nice partner in Myers Leonard, who can space the floor for him and then maybe still at times guard some of the heftier guys, although they still do defensively a lot of times, even when they have kind of like a big center and then a four who's, you know, more of a shooter or a driver. They'll still put Leonard on that guy, which I never really understood, because Leonard is just a complete traffic cone on those plays, trying to guard fours who can shoot or anyone who can drive, or if you're going to switch or something. And Davis has never really been all that strong. You know, you would think that Leonard would be a little bit better going against centers, but you know, maybe the coaching staff knows those guys. Maybe Ed Davis is, despite the fact that he looks quicker, just isn't that good at those. But intuitively, I would have expected that arrangement to switch a little bit. You ready for the Kings?
Yeah, so the Kings are 11-16. They're actually 4-1 since the last time we talked about them. They played less games than just about everybody.
They beat somebody good today. Who did they beat today?
Toronto.
Yeah,
they were up a lot early and then just held on late and did it. And they've been over.
They're actually a great matchup. I didn't see the game. How much of the game did you see?
I saw most of the second quarter, but that's all I saw.
This isn't only the case with Toronto, but the Gay and Caspi front court now with Cauley-Stein out, you know, we talked over the summer about how is George Karl going to play, right? I mean, they got these three centers that they basically want to play together at the forward positions. I'm going to play Cousins at the four. They got Rondo, who can't shoot. You know, that seems like somewhat anathema to like what George Karl normally likes to do. And I think with Cauley-Stein, who, you know, played well enough, but still it's a suboptimal configuration mostly. Now Kufos and Cousins are basically not playing together at all. Kufos is basically the backup center, and that's it. And they're going with Gay and then and Caspi a lot in the front court, and that's causing matchup problems for teams that don't have a lot of wings. Those guys really killed the Rockets when they tried to go small. They didn't. The Rockets only have one guy to defend. The Raptors, another one of those teams that especially with Carroll being out, doesn't necessarily have the horses to defend kind of two larger wings like that. So I really like the versatility of those guys around DeMarcus Cousins.
They only played eight guys tonight, the five starters, which you would expect, and then Collison, Bellinelli, and Costa Kufos. And so you think about the geometry of the floor, the spacing and all that, that's a group that makes sense to me. Like you can see how that works and how that can beat a team like the Raptors or a lot of other teams. And Willie Cauley-Stein's a really good player. I'm not criticizing him in any way. I think he's done a nice job for them. But the combinations that come into play when they add in some of these other pieces, basically anybody outside of those eight, just make them a more beatable team.
The Kings are over 500 in games that Cousins has played more than 15 minutes. They are 10-8, despite the fact that they already did an East Coast trip, and now they're on one again already within the first 2 months of the season. I'd spend some time looking at Cousins' post-ups. He is having overall an inefficient season, although he still really helps the team a lot offensively just with his usage and you know, what he's able to create for others and just the threat that he constitutes. But it's where he catches the ball is a huge thing for him, because synergy, and this can kind of be difficult because they distinguish between ISOs and post-ups, and sometimes the line for those can be difficult. You know, what's a post-up? You catch the ball with your back to the basket 20 feet away and back down. Is that an ISO? Is that a post-up? But, you know, generally ISOs start further away, post-ups start closer. And on ISOs, Cousins has been horrendous. You know, basically 0.5 points per possession, which is among the worst in the league. And he has a lot of those possessions. I think he's had like 50 of them so far this year. But on post-ups, he's above the league average. And so that shows to me, I mean, he, you know, isn't in the best of condition this year, I think, compared to last year, at least when he started the year. Then, you know, he had the meningitis scare, and that, I think, was a setback for him. And so a lot of times he'll just kind of lazily just stand there, hold his hand out, get the ball 20 feet from the rim, and then try to turn and face and drive in. And that just has not worked for him at all. He needs to, when he fights harder for position, he's much more of a threat. He's much more in a position to pass as well. You know, I think when we saw against Houston, he would catch the ball so far from the hoop, and then he would be doubled, and he just didn't really have the passing angle because he's so far away to reach everywhere on the court. And it's easier to defend that, and you can force turnovers off those longer passes. So him getting good position, and then he has a guy in Rondo who is actually excellent at throwing those passes, you know, if he's fronted as well. I mean, if he gets better position, you can force the front. So that's going to be a key aspect for him to get more efficient, is just getting closer catches to the rim.
And his three-point shooting has come back to earth. He's at 31% right now. But I'm somebody who will always love the trail three, especially when they're running, because teams just lose track of that fifth guy. And so he doesn't always have to shoot three. Sometimes you can do different things with a trail guy. But it's crazy to have a guy in Cousins who's so physically talented be that person, because he's somebody who can actually do things in that spot if they respect his shot.
Yeah, I think it's more useful when he's playing center than when he's playing power forward. When he's playing power forward, he needs to really just back the guy down. But a center is going to have to, he'll have, it's exactly what you said, that the center will have naturally sunk into the paint. He catches it on the trail, and then that guy's got to run all the way out to the top of the key. And he's shooting it well enough that he at least requires a little bit of a closeout. And then Cousins has been effective driving past those guys at times as well. Let's get to San Antonio, 23-5, 6-1 in their last seven, completely dominating. And they really, I think, are almost as good as the Warriors, if not as good at this point. And, you know, Kawhi Leonard continues to dazzle offensively.
He does, and he was somebody who, when I was looking at, you know, different situations with the synergy stuff that's on NBA.com, and he pops in every category, not every category, but a lot of them. He's third right now in transition points per possession. He's top 10 in isolations, post-ups, and spot-ups. And so you think about a guy who's not regarded as, you know, he's the reigning defensive player of the year. He's a defensive guy. To have that kind of a resume right now, because, I mean, we're still early on, but that's, you know, there have been a lot of players that have stood out so far. To be able to do all that with the defense that he's been playing is remarkable.
Yeah, that is true. I spent a lot of time actually preparing for the podcast, watching some of his post-ups and isolations and trying to determine what he's doing. Is it sustainable? And how would I try to defend that? Because he's not a guy that you think of as having an absolutely blinding first step. He's not a guy that you think of as being unbelievably skilled, although he's really is getting to that point. And he has amazing touch, you know, especially on like kind of floaters and hook shots. If he gets into the middle or even turnarounds, and he's got those long arms, so they're really hard to block. And he's real strong too. You know, he's able to get to his spot. He has great patience, and he can just kind of back down and do what he wants to do. He'll get to the middle and force help. And then he's able to, at times, find people. I think from being right in the middle, ultimately, I think the way I would try to... Oh, and I guess the other thing I should add, too, before I get to that is the Spurs' execution really helps him. they'll run plays, especially a lot of timeouts, a lot of times sending a cross screen for him to come to the left block or the right block, and he's equally effective from either block and turning left shoulder or right shoulder, which also makes him really hard to defend one-on-one. So I think, you know, unless you have like an Andre Iguodala type of defender on him or a Jimmy Butler type, I think that, you know, he is going to continue to be effective, especially because they set a lot of great screens to get him open very close to the basket, right on the block on those cross screens. And they'll do that after they run something or at least reverse the ball over to his side as the cross screen is occurring. And their execution really helps him a lot. So, I mean, what would be your way of trying to defend him on the block, given the fact that he is very difficult to stop one-on-one at this point?
I think that he's a guy we've talked about before that it's a little bit surprising that he does as well as he does, which to me is the type of guy that you want to switch against, because he's not creating an advantage that you think is going to murder you. You know, it's not like Curry or Durant or, you know, somebody like that. That doesn't mean he's like incapable of doing something with it, but I think that gives you the best chance because it gives him a little bit less of an opening.
That's interesting. So your idea is just you're going to switch that cross screen to just not let him get the ball as deep.
Yeah, I think preventing him from getting that kind of position is more important than getting the right guy on him.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think that he if he does get one-on-one against that guy, he is going to kill him. So probably what I would do would be a little bit more of a modification of what you had in mind is, number one, you know, you help out on that cross screen. I think especially against their starting lineup with Parker, who is not really shooting threes, Tim Duncan, you know, yeah, go ahead and take your 17-footer, Tim Duncan. Like, that's a win against the Spurs offense at this point. So with those guys, I mean, LaMarcus along too, yeah, I mean, you probably don't want to give that up, but if you have to, that's probably better than Kawhi backing your guy down or catching it right on the block. So I think number one, you have that guy who's guarding the screener is usually a small, try to chuck him, and if it turns out that the guy who's guarding Kawhi isn't going to be able to get there, I think you have the guy guarding the screener switch, as you said, but stay in a fronting position and force the lob over the top. And once the lob gets there, then you double immediately. And Kawhi, to me, in the, you know, I watched his post-up possessions, and when he gets double-teamed, he can be effective when he's already gotten into the middle of the lane and he has, you know, a shooter right in front of his face to pass to, and the double-team is obvious. You know, it's become a crisis. But he did not deal well at all with real hard double-teams, and he's not a guy who's a natural passer or playmaker. And so if you double him hard, speed him up to take him out of that patience, take him out of that slow back down, getting into where he can see everybody, surprise him. And then you still have guys who, you know, are not the greatest shooters in that starting lineup. I think that is the way that I would try to defend him and make him prove that he's going to beat a hard double team, and a double team that occurs a little bit further from the basket. It's riskier, but it also prevents easy passing angles.
Doesn't that sound like exactly what the Warriors are going to do?
I would save that for the playoffs if I were them, actually.
I agree with you, but I feel like that's the end game. I think that's the end game with that kind of a set.
Yeah. All right, but I mean, Kawhi, incredibly, when he's single covered on post-ups, 1.13 points per possession, which is unbelievable for posting up half court. So if you just are going to leave your guy on an island, unless he's an unbelievable individual defender who also has a lot of strength and length, he's going to score on you and you're in big trouble. So you got to do something. And the fact that he's built himself into this force in the post is pretty fantastic.
Ready to move on to Utah?
Indeed.
Oh, wait, can I say one quick thing also? Yeah, I cracked up because when I'm putting together the records, I keep in what the last thing was, and I cracked up because usually, you know, you're modifying the cents and the total, and with the Spurs, they were 6-1 last time, they're 6-1 again, and I was like, of course, the only team that is the same on both is the San Antonio Spurs.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. I'm looking forward to watching a lot more of them in the next couple of weeks here, especially as they start playing a few better teams. Utah, 11-14, 2-5 in their last seven. The Rudy Gobert injury is killing them.
Absolutely killing them. I mean, it's just, it takes away so much of what they do well, and it's one of those injuries which we see a lot in the NBA where it just puts other guys in spots where they can't succeed to nearly the same degree as when he pushes them down in the rotation.
That's right. I mean, they already had a problem with a third big in Booker who wasn't good enough for that position, and now he's starting. They then moved, and that takes Favors out of his comfort zone really on both ends. He's much better as a power forward, I think, both offensively and defensively, because he's not a guy who's going to use his quickness to face up and blow by guys offensively. So he does better matched up against a power forward, although a lot of times they'll use the center on him anyway and have the power forward guard Gobert. And then, you know, he's not really that explosive blocking shots at the rim, but he is good for a power forward switching out and using his length on guys. So that's an issue. I mean, they tried starting Jeff Withey at center so that Favors could still be a power forward. You know, I think that maybe went okay. Like, Withey is like a, you know, destitute man's Gobert. I think they're missing Exum a lot defensively as well, I think. And that injury we thought wasn't really going to affect them that much this year, but I think it kind of has now.
Feels like you're sucking up to me with that.
What, the Exum defense?
Yeah. Yeah, because I think that his defensive value is something that's really nice for them, because while they can do the triple wing and they can do things like that, what Exum provides that's a little bit different is he's so quick for his size and for everything that it gives you a little bit of a different defensive edge. And I really like what I saw from him defensively, particularly against ones, was he's the type of guy, in a way, somewhat like Ricky Rubio for me, who he just makes the other team's guy's life hell. And when you're guarding the other team's primary ball handler, that's a perfect attribute to have. I mean, it's not the most important thing in the world, but I think it really helps. It gives them a little bit of a margin for error that they don't have without him.
Alec Burks is also really struggling for this team. He is essentially shooting like 50% at the rim for a guy who is known for his awesome finishes. That's very disappointing. Also, he's a guy that you would think of as probably the primary scorer when Hayward is off the floor. They are getting killed whenever Hayward is off the floor. They can't score at all. I mean, that's been a problem for them going back, you know, these last 3 years since Hayward became like the main guy. So Burks is another guy. I mean, a lot of talent, but after a nice start to the year, you're starting to wonder again about how good he really is. Is he a starting level player? He's on an okay contract and a guy who I think can still be effective, but you know, I'm not sure that he is like the greatest fit for Quinn Snyder's kind of read and react system. Not the most cerebral player, at least as it appears. So that's also a little bit concerning for Utah fans. But the good news is the rest of the West is bad. I mean, some of the statistical possessions, like ESPN's BPI, still have them like 41 wins making the playoffs. And I think once Gobert comes back, at least hopefully they can get the defense better. I mean, I think David Locke was saying that they're like 30th in defense basically since Gobert went out.
Whew. Yeah. I mean,
although they have played Oklahoma City twice in that stretch, which does not help you much.
It doesn't. And they faced the Spurs, and the Spurs did really well against them too.
All right. Are we done?
Yeah. Unless you want to talk about the playoff picture.
No, this is long enough. We can say that for another time here. Anything to plug before we go?
Yeah, I'll have the new League Pass alert on the Sporting News, and Warriors Weekly will both be up tomorrow by the time most people listen to this.
Fantastic. I will plug again my piece on Billy Donovan, Fred Hoiberg, and Scott Skiles on The Cauldron last week. You can find that on my Facebook page or on The Cauldron. Follow both of us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. And another great way to support the program is via that cap space code on DraftKings and SeatGeek, or via just giving us a rating or review on iTunes, which is definitely really helpful as well. So, Danny, thanks so much for coming on. We'll talk to you all next time.